Good afternoon. My name is Susan Muirhead, and today I'll be reading part one of the News Gazette, dated for this state, Tuesday, January 16th, 2018. Let's begin with the reading of some of today's headlines. The first headline reads, Disappearance of Yingying Zhang. Christensen's attorneys file for change of venue, citing media. This article is written by Ben Zigterman and is based out of Champaign. Brent, that's B-R-E-N-D-T, Christensen, C-H-R-I-S-T-E-N-S-E-N, apostrophe S, Brent Christensen's attorneys filed 12 pre-trial motions Monday, including one requesting a change of trial venue and another to dismiss the main charge against the former University of Illinois grad student, kidnapping resulting in the death of visiting Chinese scholar Yingying Zhang. They also filed 6 motions to suppress or exclude evidence they believe was obtained illegally or improperly, including the surreptitious recordings of Christensen made at a campus vigil for Ms. Zhang a day before he was arrested. U.S. District Court Judge Colin S. Bruce had set Monday as the deadline for any pretrial motions to be filed. In the motion to change venues, Christensen's lawyers asked for the trial to be moved from the federal courthouse in Urbana to the Rock Island Division of the Central District of Illinois or the Eastern Division of the Northern District of Illinois or Chicago. They are otherwise known as Chicago, so those two venues. They argued that a fair and impartial trial would be impossible due to the quote-unquote journalistic tsunami of pre-trial publicity. Not since John Ewing firebombed Judge George Miller's courtroom in 1997, they argued, has the Central District of Illinois seen another case involving such extensive, unrelenting, inflammatory, and inherently prejudicial pre-trial publicity in the local media as Mr. Christensen's. Between June 22nd and December 31st last year, his lawyers said the News Gazette published, quote-unquote, no fewer than 55 articles about the case, with coverage both of the procedural steps in the case and human interest pieces on Ms. Zhang's family. Between the News Gazette, other local newspapers, online news outlets, TV news stories, and social media, the vast majority of people in the Urbana division have been exposed to information about the case, Christensen's lawyers wrote. They also cited News Gazette commentators calling for Christensen to be killed as evidence of the quote-unquote overwhelmingly negative public response and expect media coverage to increase as the case gets closer to the trial date of February 27th. In addition to the media coverage, Christensen's lawyers said this case has had and will continue to have a deep and profound impact upon the entire University of Illinois community, its Chinese student population, and all of the residents of the 11 East Central Illinois counties that comprise the Central District of Illinois. Lawyers, no evidence. In the motion to dismiss the kidnapping resulting in death charge, Christensen's lawyers' argument is two-pronged. For one, they argue prosecutors lack evidence that Ms. Zhang was coerced or forced into Christensen's car. And second, federal prosecutors lack jurisdiction, they contend. The evidence does not suggest that Mr. Christensen forcibly seized, abducted, or carried away Ms. Zhang without her consent. This leaves the government with having to show that Mr. Christensen enticed Ms. Zhang into his car through false pretense, his lawyers wrote. Counsel is unaware of any evidence of the conversation that took place between Ms. Zhang and Mr. Christensen, or that he lured her into his car through false representations. Christensen's lawyers also argued that the case is a matter for the state, not the federal government. In their superseding indictment, when the main charge was elevated to include resulting in death, prosecutors argued it was a federal case because Christensen used instruments of interstate commerce, namely a Motorola cell phone and a Saturn Astra vehicle, in committing the alleged crime. Christensen's lawyers argued that he didn't appear to use the phone to commit the alleged crime and that if the car didn't cross state borders, it shouldn't be considered an instrument of interstate commerce. To counsel's knowledge, there's no evidence suggesting that he contacted Ms. Zhang in any way, whether by way of a telephone call or use of the internet or on his phone, his lawyers wrote. Nor is there any evidence that Mr. Christensen used his phone to demand a reward or ransom or otherwise for the specific purpose of furthering commission of the charged offense. Disturbing dreams. In a separate motion, Christensen's lawyers are seeking records on how his phone was used by authorities. They also filed motions to suppress or exclude evidence, access a sealed document, require the government to disclose any or notice of any evidence it has and access information about the jury pool. This included a motion to exclude testimony from Christensen's wife, citing marital privilege. And Christensen's wife gave statements to the FBI after conversations with her husband, where he described disturbing dreams and otherwise revealed his most private thoughts, as lawyers wrote. The motions were filed by Elizabeth Pollock, P-O-L-L-O-C-K, an assistant federal public defender in Urbana. She is one of three court-appointed lawyers defending Christensen. Prosecutors also submitted one pretrial motion requesting permission to file under seal its motion to admit evidence in order to protect the privacy of a potential witness and to not increase potential public condemnation of the accused. Both parties have until January 29th to respond to these pretrial motions. And as follow-up, Missing You Vice Scholar, attorneys add new details to timeline. This is also written by Ben Zigterman and is based out of Champaign. In new motions filed Monday, Brent Christensen's lawyers provided more details about what happened between June 9th, when visiting Chinese scholar Yingying Zhang was last seen, and June 30th, when Christensen was arrested for kidnapping her. Christensen has pleaded not guilty to charges of kidnapping, resulting in the death of Ms. Zhang, and lying to federal agents, and his trial is scheduled to begin February 27th. Here's a look at the new details, according to motions filed by Christensen's lawyers to suppress evidence they believe was obtained illegally or improperly. June 9th, 9:27 a.m., hours before Ms. Zhang was last seen, a female graduate student at the University of Illinois called the U of I police to report suspicious activity. She said she was walking on Stoughton Street between Busey and Lincoln Avenues when she was approached by a man driving a black sedan. She said the man claimed to be an undercover cop and asked her to enter his car, which she didn't do. 3 days later, after Ms. Zhang was last seen, this woman was asked to describe the man who approached her and later was asked to identify him out of an array of six photos that included a photo of Christensen. Christensen's lawyers objected to this testimony because the woman was only shown photos of men with facial hair, despite her describing the man as clean-shaven. They also cited other procedural mistakes. June 14th at about 11:45 p.m. After receiving a warrant to search Christensen's car, FBI agents knocked on the door of Christensen's apartment in Stonegate Village, waking up both Christensen and his wife. Christensen was taken to a local FBI office to be interviewed. His lawyers say he said, "I should probably ask for a lawyer in situations like this." Other agents began interviewing his wife at the apartment. Christensen's lawyers objected to the search because they say his wife didn't consent to the search until about 2 a.m., after agents had begun searching the apartment and taking photos. They also argued that the timing and circumstances of the search made Christensen's wife feel like she had no choice but to consent. June 15th, shortly after midnight, Christensen was taken to an interrogation room and advised of his rights. An hour and a half into the questioning, Christensen's lawyer said he invoked his rights, saying, "I really don't want to talk no more without a lawyer," quote unquote. The questioning stopped, and an agent called an assistant U.S. attorney who advised agents to hold Christensen in custody while it was reviewed whether he lied to a federal agent and broke the law. While waiting to be taken to the Ford County Jail, Christensen was again questioned. In their motion, Christensen's lawyers objected to the set of questioning as he had invoked his rights. June 15th, 3:04 a.m., Christensen was booked into the Ford County Jail in Paxton. June 16th, shortly after midnight, Christensen was released from custody and taken to a hotel in Rantoul, where he stayed for the night. June 16th, later that day, FBI agents met with a female associate of Christensen, who agreed to be a confidential human source and wear a recording device. June 17th, FBI agents interviewed Christensen at a local FBI office without counsel present, another interview his lawyers object to. June 23rd, the informant texted Christensen for the purpose of eliciting incriminating statements from him, his lawyers wrote. They objected to this since they say the informant was directed by the same agents who knew or should have known that defendant had twice invoked his Miranda rights. June 29th, while at the campus vigil for Ms. Zhang, the informant recorded conversations with Christensen where prosecutors say he explained the characteristics of an ideal victim. His lawyers objected to this recording for the same reason they objected to the informant's text messages. And July 3rd, after Christensen was arrested June 30th, he was taken to the Macon County Jail in Decatur. While in jail, Christensen's lawyers believe the jailmate in the cell adjacent to Christensen's was an FBI informant. The confidential source would deliberately ask defendant about his pending federal case and elicit statements from the defendant about it, Christensen's lawyers wrote. They said statements from these conversations were improperly obtained and violated Christensen's constitutional rights to counsel and against self-incrimination. The next headline reads, homeless relief, even with higher demand, shelters house all in need. This article is written by Deborah Pressey and is based out of Champaign. A harsh winter has been heaping extra demand on local emergency shelter beds, and an extra overflow site has opened for homeless men. The men's emergency shelter, housed at New Covenant Fellowship Church, can hold up to 30 per night. Last winter, it ran below capacity, averaging 22 men a night. Demand this year has been nearly double, with an average of 43 men a night seeking beds, according to Faith United Methodist Church, which hires the shelter staff. Once that shelter hits capacity, each night the extra men are being sent to an overflow site that has been opened in a Salvation Army building at 502 North Prospect Avenue in Champaign, according to the Reverend Cheryl Palmer, pastor of Faith United Methodist Church and a shelter board member. Fortunately, the Salvation Army was able to let us use their building, so we've hired additional staff and we're sending 10 to 15 men to the Salvation Army almost every night, she said. Palmer said she believes the money available to operate the men's shelter this winter will stretch to cover the extra staffing, but all funds will likely be depleted, meaning fundraising for next winter will start with no reserve. We're kind of just going on faith right now, she said. We just made the decision to not turn people away. The men's emergency shelter opened for the season this past November, earlier than planned, and about a dozen local churches, local Rotary clubs, and grants from the cities of Champaign and Urbana are being used to cover staffing, insurance, and building costs. This shelter is scheduled to close for the season March 31st, though Palmer said earlier in the winter the hope was to have enough money left to remain open past that date if necessary. Faith United Methodist Church is appealing for more donations of snacks and beverages to give to the men staying at both shelter sites, Palmer said. Anyone who wishes to help with that is being asked to contact her church's office. If they're part of a faith community, they can encourage their faith community to step up, she said. Financial donations to help make sure the shelter makes it through the winter would also be great, Palmer said. She and Mayor Major Tom McDowell of the Salvation Army of Champaign County said the higher demand is likely due to the extreme cold this winter compared with last winter, which was much milder. They hit their first real crisis the last week of December, that first real cold snap, McDowell said. We've been open since then, and right now we plan to be open through March, and that's because they're working with us to provide staff. The Champaign-Urbana canteen run has been driving the men to the Salvation Army shelter site, Palmer said. Barb Davis of the Canteen Run said three volunteers have been covering all that driving. See You at Home, which runs the Phoenix Daytime Drop-In Center for the Homeless in Champaign, has been staying open for 12-hour days when the temperatures dip to the single-digit range. It's providing a warm space for people to go from the time the overnight shelters close in the morning to the time they reopen in the evening, said the agency's executive director, Rob Dollhouse III. There's been a lot of folks from the community coming in and helping out, he said. And continuing on along that line, let's talk about the weather. Let's look at Greg Soulet's, that's S-O-U-L-J-E's, on the weather front column. So let's look at the forecast for the next few days. Today, 15 degrees. Cold, variable cloudiness, a few flurries or a couple of snow showers. Westerly winds are going to be 12 to 18 miles per hour. Gusty. Chance of snow, 40%. Overnight, bitter cold, a few flurries early, decreasing clouds, diminishing wind. Wednesday, the temperature is the high is 19, the low is negative 2. That's tomorrow. It will be cold. Mostly sunny, quite cold, northwest to west wind 6 to 12 miles per hour. Overnight, mostly clear. Thursday, we'll start getting warmer. The high will be 30, the low is 11, becoming windy, not as cold, mostly sunny. Friday, the high will be 38, the low is 21, windy, partly cloudy. And Saturday, the high will be 46, the low will be 32, windy, milder, mostly cloudy. The next headline reads, University of Illinois, returning students battle chilly temps and slippery roads. This article is written by Julie Wirth and is based out of Urbana. As the first day of classes goes, today's forecast at the University of Illinois wasn't the most hospitable on record. 3 degrees at 9 a.m. with a minus 14 wind chill. Not to mention the slippery drive back to campus for students Monday after a lengthy winter break and a 3-inch snowfall. Students headed back to the U of I and other downstate schools hit the roads Sunday night and Monday, and many found themselves sitting in traffic or sliding off the highway. Most of our accidents were U of I students, though most weren't serious, said Trooper Kurt Quick, of Illinois State Police District 21 in Ashcombe. Accidents stop traffic from time to time, with one frustrated U of I student posting on Reddit shortly before noon Monday. Anyone else stuck on 57 right now? A fatal crash that killed a Savoy driver about 10:15 a.m. Monday south of Rantoul stopped traffic in both lanes of I-57 for an extended period, according to Trooper Tracy Lillard, Public Information Officer for Illinois State Police District 10 in Pasotum. I had multiple callers contact me about why they were stuck in traffic, she said. And both lanes were shut down for about a half hour after 13 cars slid off the road along a mile-and-a-half stretch of I-57 north of Montano at about 1 p.m., Quick said. One of them was a jackknife semi, he said. U of I graduate student Annalisa Roncone got on the road about noon Monday from her home near the Illinois-Wisconsin border, nervously monitoring weather and road condition reports. After hearing about poor conditions on I-57, where blowing and drifting snow is often a problem, she turned back after just 20 minutes and took a bus instead. As I was making my way to 57, I was talking to my parents, and we just decided that it wasn't worth the risk of potentially an accident or some sort of delay, she said, adding that her car is only rear-wheel drive. The buses to Champaign from O'Hare Airport were full, so her dad drove her to Woodfield Mall to catch a 4 p.m. bus. It is packed. There may be one seat left, Roncone said, at about 5:45 p.m. as the bus merged onto a slow-moving I-57. We're moving, but not at a high rate of speed. She was due to arrive in Champaign at 7:30 p.m., about 12 hours before her first 8 a.m. class. I'll go back for my car later this week once the roads are clear, she said. Quick said the worst conditions were about 5 a.m. Monday, just as traffic along the interstate started picking up for the morning. We started getting a lot of slide-offs and a lot of property damage accidents, he said. Road conditions were still patchy Monday afternoon with some dry stretches, but others covered with snow or ice, Lillard said. It might be dry for 3 miles, then all of a sudden it turns into a sheet of ice and people are going too fast and they lose it, she said. Typically, police see heavy southbound traffic on Sunday nights from the Chicago area as students return to the U of I, Eastern Illinois, or Southern Illinois, and the Martin Luther King holiday pushed that to Monday this week, Lillard said. State police often do speed details on Friday afternoons on northbound I-57, where students are headed to Chicago for the weekend, and on Sunday nights on southbound I-57 as they return, Lillard said. During a recent check on a Sunday night, November 26 of the 29 tickets issued went to college students, she said. That means a lot of the issue is speed, and that can contribute to these crashes, too, she said. Add that to snowy weather and bad road conditions, and it's a mess. Quick said he ticketed one U of I student for reckless driving near Kankakee on Sunday before the storm. His speed, 112 miles per hour. The next headline reads, De-icing roads. No matter how much you clean, salt still punishes all. This article is written by Adalberto, that's Adalberto, Toledo. With fresh snow once again blanketing the area, fleets of trucks armed with road salt have renewed their attack on the white menace. But as anyone who has ever walked out in their dress shoes knows, road salt can wear and tear at everything. I don't drive my car in the winter months, said Leroy Gaston, detailing manager at Andy's Enterprise and Auto Beauty in Champaign. I know not many people can do that, but whatever you do, your car's still going to die a slow death, Gaston said. From the damage it does to your shoes to the effects it could have on the environment, road salt has been called into question as the best solution to the wintry problem. The city of Champaign alone goes through about 35,000 tons of it in an average winter, Public Works Chris Koester, K-O-E-S-T-E-R, says. That's K-R-I-S, Koester. Urbana began the winter season with 1,340 tons on hand and plans to purchase another 1,440 for the year through the Illinois Joint Purchasing Program, the city's John Collins says. With the very cold temps and type of snow so far, we have used more than I would like for this time of year, Collins said. We do take into account every factor involved in a winter event so that we can minimize salt usage to protect the environment, yet provide the best service that we can. Gaston warned that there's not much one can do to prevent the damage salt does to vehicles. All you can really do, as a rule, is always wash your car as much as you can and wax it a couple of times a year. When he buys old cars, Gaston prefers to get them from southern states like Texas and Louisiana, where you won't find shelves full of road salt at hardware stores like you do here. Recently, he said, a 14-year-old pickup truck came into his shop and looked almost pristine at first sight, but the universal joint, the part of the vehicle that holds the shaft in place for rear-wheel drive cars, was cut almost clean off by rust from salt damage. Salt leather, a bad mix. Van Boyd, V-A-N, last name B-O-Y-D, Van Boyd, manager at the Urbana Shoe Repair Store Heel & Toe, says it will set you back $10 to get the white streaking from the salt off your shoes. Oftentimes, dressier shoes have a thin outer layer of leather that can wear out pretty fast in the salt, and without proper care, your shoes can never look the same again, he said. He recommended wearing boots to get to work and waiting until you get inside to slip on your dress shoes. He also gives this quick solution to the white staining. A solution of half water, half white vinegar will do. Just scrub it out with that. Tracy, T-R-A-C-Y, Wingler, W-I-N-G-L-E-R, maintenance supervisor for the Champaign County Highway Department, said he still has 2,000 tons of salt in storage and another 2,000 in reserve that hasn't been delivered yet. Just handling road salt can dry out your skin, he says, and the liquid salt the department uses on some trucks can burn your skin if the temperature is low enough. Fortunately, he said, it doesn't do much damage to the roads. But salt runoff from de-icing missions may be adversely affecting freshwater rivers, streams, and other bodies of water across North America, according to a study published a week ago in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. It found that these bodies of water have become saltier and more alkaline, in part because of the rock salt used on roads across the North. Across 232 U.S. Geological Survey monitoring sites, 66% of streams and rivers showed an increase in pH caused by salt pollution, which included road de-icers. It's the best we've got. Few alternatives to rock salt exist, though. Wingler said he hasn't worked with any that do the job quite as well. One such alternative, molasses-based beet juice mixed with rock salt, can help melt ice below its 15-degree limit. But it's sticky, Wingler said, and many people have complained of the cumbersome effect on cars when the county used it more than a decade ago. Another solution may come from our neighbors up north. In Wisconsin, not surprisingly, cheese brine is spread all over roads in at least a half dozen counties, according to the state's Department of Transportation. It's a waste product from cheese production that's mixed with salt. For now, though, Wingler said there's no good alternative to the moisture-sucking, car-damaging, shoe-destroying salt. Right now, it's the best we've got, he said. And now let's take a look at Top of the Morning, something to get you going today, courtesy of Jim Rosso. That's R-O-S-S-O-W. On Tuesdays, we'll introduce the kids behind High School Confidential. Today, Georgetown Ridge Farms' Willow Ray, a senior who seemingly has a hand in everything. She plays basketball, volleyball, and is in the band, helps put out Georgetown Ridge Farms' newspaper, and participates in Scholastic Bowl and National Honor Society. If it's something I really like to do, I'll make time for it, Ray said. Headed to Danville Area Community College, the energetic 18-year-old will show Georgetown Ridge Farm in all of its glory when she takes over our Snapchat account on Thursday. Follow along by searching for News Gazette on the app. The best thing about Georgetown Ridge Farm? The teachers, definitely, she said. They are all very compassionate about their job and are willing to do whatever it takes to get you where you need to be. What was trending in the online audience last week at News Gazette? .com, which in a 7-day period ending Sunday saw 1,179,129 page views. The three top stories were: 1, Hobby Co. files for bankruptcy, layoffs next; 2, Central High administrator hailed for heroism during shooting; and 3, Champaign caretaker accused of molesting child. The three top sports stories were: 1, Illini hand out 2 more offers; 2, Big Ten hoops, when will the Illini win; 3, viral video, Kaleo Terry's monstrous dunk. Three top videos: 1, Crime Stoppers, St. Joseph burglaries; 2, Underwood, We've Got to Get Better; and 3, Game of the Week, Central at Centennial Boys Basketball. The three top photo galleries were: 1, Paula Poundstone at the Virginia; 2, High School Boys Basketball, Rantoul versus PBL, that's Paxton Buckley Loda; and 3, U of I Wrestling versus Northwestern. In history, area history. In 1918, The fuel administrator for Iowa proposed shutting down businesses and industries on Saturdays, Sundays, and Mondays for 2 weeks in Illinois, Iowa, Indiana, and Missouri due to the coal shortage. The reduction in coal production because of the recent winter storms was the reason given for the conservation effort. In 1968, the Andersons, a 12 million bushel elevator being built west of Champaign, would be operational by September, said Thomas H. Anderson, one of the 54 Anderson family members who were partners in the operation. Under construction were 24 storage tanks each with a capacity of 485,000 bushels. In 2003, the state's retirement systems all lost money in the troubled financial markets in 2002, meaning more tax dollars would have to go into those pension programs in the next budget year, according to reports released by Auditor General Bill Holland. The state university's retirement system investment portfolio lost $776 million between June 30, 2001 and June 30, 2002, plus another $659 million between that date and November 8, 2002, Holland reported. The next headline reads, Crash on Interstate 57. Man 58 dies after crossing median. This article is written by Ben Zigterman and is based out of Thomasboro. A Savoy man died Monday morning after losing control of his car on Interstate 57, according to Illinois State Police. The 58-year-old man was northbound at 10:18 a.m. near milepost 246 near Thomasboro in a Chevrolet pickup truck when he lost control, State Police said. He slid sideways through the median and entered the southbound lanes where he was struck on the driver's side by a Ford box truck. That driver was unable to avoid the crash, state police said, and while the crash is still under investigation, no tickets were issued. Both drivers were taken to an area hospital. The Savoy man died from his injuries at the hospital, state police said. The other driver, a 65-year-old man from Pakistan, has non-life-threatening injuries. Both drivers were wearing seatbelts, state police said. The next headline reads, Illinois Department of Health. Passenger with measles flew through O'Hare. This article is written by the Associated Press and is based out of Chicago. State health officials are advising anyone who was at Chicago O'Hare International Airport last Wednesday and hasn't been vaccinated for measles that they should be tested for the highly contagious disease. The Illinois Department of Public Health recommendation comes after a passenger who flew in and out of the airport that day was confirmed to have the disease. The Chicago Tribune reported that the passenger's flight landed at Terminal 5, the international terminal, on Wednesday morning and departed on a domestic flight out of Terminal 1. The department said the passenger who was infectious that day may have gone to other areas of the airport and that people who were at the airport between 6:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. on Wednesday could have been exposed. The next headline reads, Winter Weather. Storm blankets Chicago area with up to 5 inches of snow. This article is written by the Associated Press and is based out of Chicago. Road crews are preparing for a winter storm that's already covered the ground with a blanket of snow in the Chicago area and is expected to dump as much as 5 inches before it moves on. After the National Weather Service issued a winter weather advisory Monday afternoon, the city of Chicago deployed more than 200 plows across the city, while the Illinois Department of Transportation deployed another 400 plows to clear expressways and other state roads in Cook, DuPage, Lake, McHenry, and Kane counties. Some communities, such as Belvedere and McChesney Park, declared snow emergencies that prohibit people from parking on the street to make room for plows. I'm Susan Muirhead, and this has been part one of the News Gazette, dated for this state, Tuesday, January 16th, 2018, the day after Martin Luther King Day. We'll resume shortly with part two of the News Gazette. Stay with us. Thank you very much for listening, and we hope you have a wonderful day.